and welcome to the EDH Retcast. My name is Joey Schultz, and I'm joined, as always, by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, he put a bunch of plus one counters onto Thalise Reverent Medium, which of course means that now she's Thalise Reverent Large. It's Matt Morgan.
So I figured out the next dog that I'm going to get, I'm going to name them 10 miles. That way I can frequently say, like, I'm going to go walk 10 miles now.
And that'll be impressive. Will you walk 10 miles, 10 miles, or 1 mile?
No, that's the point. I don't want to actually do it. I want to just name the dog that.
Just say you did it.
Right? Yeah. Just want to say that you did it. I like it. I like it a lot. Up next, he can't help but notice that Umbris Fear Manifest doesn't have fear, and it also doesn't manifest anything. What's with that? It's Dana Roach.
What do you give a dog with a fever?
I'm not sure. Its name might be 10 miles, so I know that Matt cares about this a lot, but go ahead and tell me, Dana.
Mustard and ketchup. It's probably the best thing for a hot dog.
Matt, I need you to know that I hold you personally responsible for the elevated level of dad jokes that have occurred on this channel.
This is, it's like Inception, where they're like, they go in, like, it's a dad joke within a dad joke.
Whatever it is, it's far too much. I appreciate you both. Anyway, this is the EDH Reccast. EDH Rec is the best deck building resource on the web for the Commander format, compiling data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new Commander decks. And here on the podcast, what we'd like to do is give all of that data a little more context. Dana, tell us, what is it that we're talking about in this episode?
We're going to be talking about the most complex commanders in EDH. It's going to be off the leash.
Are you fitting another joke in there? In addition to giving more data, more context, we are also purveyors of truly facepalm-inducing dad jokes, for which I can only apologize. But listeners, we appreciate each and every one of you. And yeah, we are talking about the most complex commanders in EDH. There are a bunch of cool commanders out there that are a bit, you know, straightforward in the ways that they play, and they can have some cool tricks. But then there are also some commanders that are very complex just in the nature of trying to play them, and they require a lot of forethought and studying and leaning forward. And we want to talk about those and how rewarding some of those can be. Real quick, before we get into our main show, let's thank Josh LeQuiet and the folks at the Command Zone who handle the post-production work on the podcast, making it look as awesome as it does. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors for the show too.
The EDH Retcast is sponsored by Card Kingdom and TCG Player, two online retailers you can truly call man's best friend. Simply head over to EDH Rec and click on the card in question and go to the vendor link down below. Doing that supports both the site and the show.
And if you'd prefer to support the show directly, you can walk yourself over to patreon.com/EDH Retcast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Whether you want to mark your territory in our Discord community, you're more than welcome to do that. Just keep PG, please. Or you want to see all the historic challenge stats, we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Whatever you want out of it, we definitely have a perk for you there. So make sure you head over to patreon.com/EDH Retcast. And we have a very special tier where we call out for somebody. A very special call out just for joining the Patreon. So this week we want to give a very special shout out to Chloe Sparrow. So thank you so much, Chloe. We appreciate your support. We're giving you quite the treat here by that shout out that we do every single week.
Okay. I need the dad dog jokes. I need to tell you guys, and I mean this in all sincerity, stop trying to make fetch happen. It's never going to happen.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Nice. Let's move into our show before I have a conniption. You guys are so terrific. Oh, man. All right. Our main topic here, we are talking about the most complex EDH decks. And I guess real quick, I'll actually ask, like, is the complexness, is that a thing that really appeals to you? Dana, we'll start with you. Is this like a thing that you really enjoy, finding those like specific nuances and unlocking those cool, complicated board states and stuff like that and working your way, puzzling through those? Or is EDH something that you tend to, you know, lean back a little bit more and just like have more of a, you know, just more of an easygoing time? What is something that you tend to look for? Is this a style that you really enjoy?
I tend to like some complexity in the commanders I choose, but it's a tough line to walk. Number one, if things get too complex, it can become time-consuming. It can become kind of annoying for people who don't know really what's going on. If you know you're doing too many weird interactions, and I've sometimes found that like the more complex the commanders get, you sometimes wind up with decks that are pretty linear. They're asking for really specific cards if the commander's doing a certain thing, and it's kind of tough maybe for me to find the character I want from a deck sometimes in those cases. So,
okay.
Yes, I like some complexity. I'm not going to be running, you know, a commander that just has trample or something from back in Legends. but yeah, it's a kind of a fine line to walk for sure.
That makes sense. And Matt, I mean, when Dana said old commander that just has trample, I mean, that sounds like it's really the type of thing that you definitely do enjoy. Where are you on the complexity appeal, do you think?
Well, I do like trample, but I do like my commanders to have a little more sauce than that to them. But that said, also, like, I don't know if you know this about me, but like, I am not a very good player. So if you've ever watched twitch.tv/EDHRetcast, I make a lot of mistakes. There's a lot to track. Don't let the fact that like I've qualified for like all the invitationals and all the paper tournaments fool you. I'm not a great player. So with that said, the more that there is to track, the more I lose interest in a potential commander, because like what Dana was saying, like eventually there either gets to be so much going on that it loses its interest for me, at least. So there has to be a little bit of flavor to it. There has to be a little bit of stuff going on, but also there is a point of diminishing returns when once a commander gets so complex, I start to lose interest with it. And it's the same with just cards that go in the 99. We'll talk about this at the very end of the episode. But there's some cards that are just, it's so hard to understand what the card does. It makes me not even want to try it.
I love the way you characterize it there, diminishing returns, because the most important point for this for me is definitely what you said there about interest. Like, if this is something that appeals to folks, that is a cool thing. But if a complex commander doesn't appeal to folks, that's not any moral judgment on that person. And it's not anything about, like, sometimes you just want to lean back and have a cool vibe. I've got a bunch of decks that I play that are specifically devoted to just, you know what, these are a bunch of zombies and they just attack and go rar, or they eat your brains. And that's just a really fun. And then there are times that I want to, you know, crank things up a bit and really test my own mental prowess in the game. But that's not always the experience that I always want. So, you know, both of them are completely cool types of ways to play. We're just going to talk about fun, complex ones, some of our personal favorites that might show up here. But yeah, Matt, I really love the way that you said it there, because it is a matter of personal interest, and that can be such a personal thing. So let's get into it. Dana, let's start it off with you. What's a personal favorite complex commander out there in the world of EDH for you?
The first one that kind of pops up for me, it'll be Breya, Aetherium Shaper. And you can tell Breya is going to be complicated because the creature type line is an extra small text to fill in legendary artifact creature human there.
Yeah.
And then Breya has, you know, modular abilities, essentially. She's a 4-4 and comes into play and creates 2/1/1 blue Thopter artifact creature tokens. And then you have a couple of choices. You can spend 2 mana to sacrifice 2 artifacts and either deal 3 damage to a player, give a creature -4/-4 to end a turn, or gain 5 life. And none of those necessarily, like, looking at them seem that powerful, but in an artifact deck that tends to have a lot of complexity anyway, because artifacts are complicated and a lot of interaction, there's a whole lot you can do with a Breya deck. And it's one of those things you kind of don't realize until you're playing against it or playing with it.
I think that is such a good pick. I mean, first of all, the fact that she's 4 colors, like, that gives you so near infinite options. But yeah, artifacts, I think, are just artifact decks generally are a great thing to shout out here. They can be exceptionally fun, but they can also be exceptionally fiddly. Your scrap trawlers are going to, like, pull things back out of their graveyards. You're going to sacrifice things to Clan Ironworks. Your Foundry Inspectors are going to make them all cost 1 less, but maybe not these spells. And you have to sacrifice these things to try and search for other artifacts. And which one do you need? Like, all of those can be, there's so many moving pieces. It literally feels like you're studying a piece of machinery while you're trying to play some of those decks. So Breya is a really good choice, but also I feel like it's just a stand-in for nearly any artifact deck here, because there can be so much that's going on with them.
Well, you have the complexity of both being an artifact-centric deck with an artifact commander, and the complexity of you as an opponent are playing this mini game where you're like, okay, are there 2 artifacts the Breya player is willing to sacrifice?
Oh, yeah.
Does the Breya player have 2 mana available to use it? Do I have a creature that can be killed with a -4/-4? Is the thing I want to play this turn able to die with that -4 ability? So I do not want to play it. You wind up, you know, in with yourself having to keep track of multiple different things at a time. I've been in the situation, even the 5 life thing, where like, I think I can kill the Breya player. I have to pay attention. Well, they've got 6 mana available, and I see 3 artifact lands over there. So dealing 12 damage isn't enough. I have to deal 27.
And honestly, like, also so many of these artifact commanders are also so famous for combos, and combos can be really complex parts of this too. And I think, if anything, these can be so complicated to play that even when you're trying to avoid infinite combos, your deck may still accidentally contain some. Like, that's how nuanced some of these artifact decks can get.
Yeah, I've seen Brea players discover combos in their decks as they're playing, completely unintentionally put them in there. There's like, oh, well, all these moving pieces seem to like each other, and now I've accidentally like made infinite mana, and I didn't even mean to because I didn't know how these cards work together.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting way to play and really, really appealing. I think each of us has built artifact decks here and there, but it is also the kind of thing that I do feel like I need to sort of gear up myself mentally in order to prepare for.
Yeah, I mean, it just very much creates a dog-eat-dog game situations where you just have to at all times be ready for anything to happen.
I can't even be mad. Dana, that was well done. I'm laughing. Okay. Well done. That's great. Another one here that I definitely want to shout out and was for me kind of the inspiration for this show topic is definitely Obeka Brute Chronologist. This is, I don't know, this is just a commander that knowledge of the rules and even of errata becomes pretty relevant when you're talking about Obeka. So this one's the Grixis commander from Commander Legends that can tap, and then the player whose turn it is may end the turn, which exiles all spells and abilities from the stack. The player whose turn it is discards down to their maximum hand size. Damage wears off, and any this turn or until end of turn effects will end. And this is a really, really, really cool commander to use, but there are a lot of ways in which it gets really complex really, really fast. So a classic thing that you might do with it is to use a card like Ideas Unbound, 2 mana, you draw 3 cards, but at the beginning of your next end step, you will have to discard 3 cards. So you'll wait until your end step, wait for that delayed negative trigger to go onto the stack, and then you'll use Obeka to remove, you'll just end the turn, and that ability will go away completely. But that itself is already kind of requiring a whole lot of rules knowledge. In fact, you have to wait for the trigger to go onto the stack rather than just ending your turn before you hit the end step. It gets complex, even just trying to explain it. So this is a very cool commander for sure, but knowing how all of those nuances work, it takes a whole lot of brain work.
Yeah, commanders that deal around with like specific timings of interactions, those always added just an entirely different layer. It might give you pause to look at Obeka.
Matthew! Playing.
I mean, like, you pause a little bit, like, you give it a second thought. I was being quite literal, Joseph.
She literally stops time. No, it's perfect. You guys are killing me. That's so good. We might just need to tap Obeka and just end things right now if this is going to keep going, though.
We
but
could.
Yeah, here's the other thing, though, is that also it kind of requires some knowledge of knowing the difference between at end of turn, which has been errated to now say at the beginning of the next end step, versus effects that end until end of turn, which is different and which Obeka doesn't really actually play around with. And that requires you to know like some ways that cards have been errated in the past if you actually want to successfully play with them. And there are tons of great rewards if you manage to pull this off. You can permanently keep token copies around with stuff like Felden of the Third Path or Around Me of the Dead Tide. So there are so many cool effects that you can pull off with this commander. But again, the rules knowledge is pretty intense here, and it's really fun to watch. It's really fun to play if you can, but it also just does take a lot of fortitude, I think, in order to figure out how all of those moving parts actually fit together. And Matt, I'm still thinking about your pause joke, and now I need to pause. That was brilliant.
Thank you. But I'm going to throw out my own commander that I think is very mechanically difficult, complex. There's a lot going on here. So Mishra, Artificer Prodigy, that card, I still probably don't even know fully what it does. There's a lot going on with this. So this is an old commander from Time Spiral, which was one in Grixis color. So a blue, a black, and a red for a legendary human artificer that says, whenever you play an artifact spell, you may search your graveyard, hand, and or library for a card with the same name as the spell and put it into play. If you search your library this way, you shuffle it. So right off the bat, you think, well, why would you even play that in a singleton format? Because you can't find anything with the same name. That's just not how it works. So Mishra actually is a weird, like, there's a bunch of weird interactions. There are two big cards that kind of play into the stacks type of deck this becomes, where you're playing around with cards while they're on the stack. One is Possibility Storm, which in itself is an extremely complicated card. There's a whole bunch of lines of text there, where basically you get to play around with triggers. But Blood Funnel is one that's much more straightforward, that's much easier for me to explain on this podcast. So Blood Funnel interacts with Mishra in a very interesting way. Blood Funnel makes all of your non-creature spells you play cost 2 mana left to cast, which is great. But whenever you play a non-creature spell, you counter that spell unless you sacrifice a creature. So what happens is whenever you cast an ability, you put Mishra's triggered ability onto the stack where you can search your library, or what you're specifically going to be searching in this case is the graveyard. Mm-hmm. So you let the Blood Funnel ability trigger. You're not going to sacrifice a creature because the Blood Funnel makes you sacrifice one. So you want that spell actually to get countered. Once that spell is countered, then you let Mishra's ability resolve where you get to search your graveyard for a card with the same name as the spell you cast. So even though the spell got countered, Mishra's ability hasn't yet resolved. So you're able to pull that spell out of your graveyard and put it into play. It's a really weird little interaction that originally I think was more meant to protect your spells from being able to be countered. So if you're playing in a very like counterspell heavy play group, Mishra might be a good option to cheat those artifacts into play and make sure they're essentially uncounterable, even though they're always getting countered, which is a really weird way to say that.
I mean, all of that just for the bonus that Blood Funnel provides of making your non-creature spells 2 mana less to cast. All of that rules just went into just that small interaction, and that this commander, which doesn't look like it works in a singleton format, can make work, but it's all with weird synergies like that just to provide a minus 2 mana discount on your non-creature spells.
Yep.
And that's not even, you didn't even like go into too much detail about Possibility Storm, which I don't think we have actual time to do. But
we don't have time on this podcast or next week or the week
after.
We're
going to let that sleeping dog lie. That's just too much work, I think.
Yes.
Dang it. Beautifully done. No.
But no, I mean, what's interesting about Mishra is you're dealing with a commander that itself is very complicated, that basically wants to run a bunch of cards like Possibility Storm, or I think Planar Chaos is one you see a lot, that are themselves very, very complicated. So your complexity in that deck is, it's kind of a complexity multiplier, kind of.
Honestly, that's true. Any of the decks that are like kind of like just being pure chaos, I mean, when you hear the words Possibility Storm, there are a whole bunch of other things like the Scramble Versus of the world as well, or things that just like set up a brand new, you know, everything, all targets are chosen at random. I think maybe that card is Planar Chaos. Like there's just so many others, and like just keeping track of what the board state is supposed to be when stuff like Time Sifters are turning different people's turns around in different ways, that also kind of leans into a very similar theme that Mishra begins to unlock. And absolutely. In fact, this one is twisting my mind up so much that I think I need to escape from this spiral. And so let's just move on to the next one before I think too hard about this crazy machine.
Well, I mean, with the Blood Funnel, like you got to be careful. You might turn into a Bloodhound with that card. So
nice.
Matt,
I forced that one really hard, but I'm not going to apologize.
This is a very rough episode for me.
Oh, so we're going to Joey's on board.
Oh,
oh man. All right. Let's talk next about Nimrus Uno's Trickster, which I think is complex in a completely different way than some of the others we've talked about so far. Just because I guess the play patterns of Nimrus kind of require your attention at all times. And that is a thing that can be a little bit mentally exhausting. So Nimrus is the 5-mana 1/6 Fairy Knight in Dimir from Commander Legends. It has flash and flying. And whenever you cast your first spell during each opponent's turn, you look at the top 2 cards of your library, put one of them into your hand, and the other one into your graveyard. And on its face, this is a very straightforward effect. You play stuff on an opponent's turns and you'll get some extra bonuses from that, and that can be a really great source of card advantage and of filling the graveyard if you would like it to be. The thing that makes this so tricky is that it requires you to constantly be on alert for when is the correct time to play stuff on every single player's turn. Often, maybe not even your own, because so much of your stuff will be at instant speed, but you have to time literally everything that you're doing to make sure that it fits in with what every other player is doing. So you always have to stay alert and be involved in what other players are doing. And you never really get that small breathing space to lean back and be like, all right, cool, I did my stuff. There aren't any ever tapped out moments there where you just lean back and whatever may come. Nimrus requires you to constantly be on alert, which can be certainly a very fun style of play, but it can also certainly be a whole big meal of a style of play too.
Yeah, you got to be a real watchdog about what you're doing on other people's turns.
Excuse me, watchdog is a Selesnya card. That's
That's you know what, Joey? Just go lay down. Let me make this happen. But yes, like Joey said, you have to be diligent, making sure that it's the right person's turn to be doing all your things on. It's a very good point. You don't always want to be waiting till the absolute last second, because it's kind of telegraphed then. So making sure that you kind of have a little bit of play going on over there. I mean, it's always fun to go play. That's undeniable.
Dana, I need you to say any other words now, because Matt is barking up the wrong tree here. So let's just move it on. These buns are too much. We have hit a limit, I swear. Oh, my goodness.
Well, so since we are talking about commanders that require you to be vigilant on everyone's turn, let's talk about Glissa the Traitor. Glissa is a first strike death touch zombie, 3-3, and that alone is a bit to keep track of. The way first strike and death touch interact is something you wind up having to explain to people sometimes. You know, particularly when they're swinging into you at the 5-5 that doesn't have trample, let alone if you happen to give Glissa trample and swing in and have to explain how first strike and death touch and trample all interact.
Mm.
And that's all before we get to the fact that she has an ability that says whenever a creature an opponent controls is put into the graveyard, you may return target artifact card from your graveyard to your hand. So now you have triggers going on constantly, even on other players' turns when you're not involved, when, like, you know, player to your left attacks the player across the table and someone's creature dies, that generates a trigger for you to bring an artifact back. And if you're playing Fedalkin Orrery, then maybe you can even cast it and use it. And there's just a lot constantly going on with that commander for people to keep track of, including yourself. And then the added thing I've noticed in the last year or two is because this card is so old now, we're talking like, I want to say almost 15 years, people don't know what it is. You actually encounter people that I play this card and they're like, what is that? Where did that come from? So you have to explain it and like read the ability repeatedly because they're not familiar with the card at this point. There's just a lot to keep track of when you're playing Glissa. And as someone who plays the deck regularly, I still screw it up all the time.
I feel like that last part, Dana, might just be that you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
There you go.
You're the old dog in this metaphor.
Joey. No, I'm the old dog in every metaphor.
Joey, okay. Seriously, though, Joey, having had a Glissa deck for a little bit myself, you're absolutely right. Like the fact that there's always going to be triggers going on there, the timing of them, like you do a lot of retrieving from your graveyard. And so it gets really complicated to keep up with. And yeah, sometimes I'm actually very, very impressed with Dana just being able to track every single trigger going on there.
And especially, I think it's important to note, too, like there are other commanders that have, you know, for example, death triggers when opponent's creatures die, like Sengir the Dark Baron, for example, gets a lot of plus one counters when enemy creatures die. But there is a very characteristic difference between watching opponent's creatures die and retrieving something from your graveyard that Dana, as you mentioned, you might be able to even play at instant speed. And maybe like you have those baubles like Mishra's Bauble that you play in your deck, which also sacrifice themselves so that you constantly have a full graveyard. That is a different dynamic than an opponent's creatures died and I just put two plus one counters on to my creature here.
No, like, Joey, I'm really disappointed with you, actually. I said retrieving, and you didn't have anything to say about the dogs. And Glissa's even a gold card, so you might even say Glissa is a golden retriever.
I'm sorry, Matt. I guess I'm just hitting a bit of a rough pooch. I mean, a rough patch.
Ooh. His bark is worse than his bite, Matt. Don't let him get you this, down.
I mean, expecting me to force a joke in there is the least you could do.
I think at this point, we've like provided much more dog dad joke than we have provided actual Magic content here. So this is what a fun energy.
That's what people go to patreon.com/EDHRecast for.
Goodness gracious. But anyway, yes, Dana, watching you pilot that Glissa deck is very impressive because it is constantly exploding a bunch of stuff all over the place. And it just doesn't seem like the kind of deck that you should play when it's like the third game of the night, you know?
Absolutely not. I have like a hard time limit. Like it's after 9 p.m. I'm not touching it.
Yeah, that's when the gremlins were just like, we can't give this one water or food or whatever, because this one, it's just going to be a bit too much for sure. I'll round out one other here that, I mean, I feel like we also have to mention this here. And it's funny because we keep mentioning Grixis commanders, but Mersil the Pretender is kind of a lot to deal with. I mean, it's a whole bunch of fun. It is a really, really great puzzle to actually do when to try and solve, but it is also a whole lot to go through. Marisol the Pretender, Grixis again, a 4/4 human wizard. When it enters the battlefield, you can exile an artifact or creature from your hand or graveyard with a cage counter on it, and then it gets all of the activated abilities of the things that you exile with cage counters, but you can only do each of them once each turn. And this one absolutely opens up the doors for crazy weird combos, but not only do you have to remember which activated abilities you actually have and which things you have, you know, placed into exile, but you also have to keep track of which abilities you have actually used this turn so far. So that gets very, very complicated to try and deal with when you are trying to play Marisol, even whether it's combo or if you're playing it honestly, because there's just so much to track on it.
Yeah, like I can never remember which of the three uncommons that were last printed when Bill Clinton was president you have exiled under Marisol. Like trying to just keep track of that information as your opponent. The Marisol player is constantly like pulling the cards out and reading them to see what abilities they have, let alone you who isn't playing the deck. It's a lot to keep track of.
Right, so I have to use the Quicksilver Elemental to gain all activated abilities of target creature until end of turn, but I'm targeting my own Marisol. I also have the ability of a Cavern Harpy, which lets me return things, and there's a Horseshoe Crab that can untap, but then I also have some other untappers, but then some tap effects. It gets so much, so complicated, and as you mentioned, it is with some pretty obscure old cards, so even just knowing what those cards do can be enough.
I mean, my enthusiasm for listening to Marisol cards really tailed off at the end there. I think we need to move on.
This, Matt, I just need you to know, this is a core key moment for us to address that this has become an issue. You're right. We do need to move
on. If you could see my face right now, I'm so disappointed. I really hope you don't tear yourself up about it.
It's all right. I forgive you. So how about after we've become so derailed that I think what we need to do is a hard reset. So how about instead of talking about these complex commanders, which are clearly too much for us and we're getting into a delirious state as a result of it, how about we pause right now to go to one of our favorite segments and challenge the stats? It is our favorite segment here on the show because there's so much data on Idiotrek, but we don't always agree with it. Sometimes I think the cards see too much or too little play. So we love to challenge those statistics. Matt, will you start us off this week? What is your challenge?
I will play the lead dog here. Absolutely. So this week, I have another one of those cards that I believe I've seen Dana play a couple times. But every time I see somebody mention this card, I can't believe that I haven't put it into more decks. And it's just one of those commons that just make those little quality of life upgrades. This card is Reckless Impulse. So it is a sorcery for one in a red, and it says exile the top two cards of your library, and until the end of your next turn, you can play those cards. It's basically just a red sign in blood. You don't have to lose any life, but since you're exiling the top two cards of your library, there are two specific commanders that are already playing this card, but I think they need to be playing them much, much more. And specifically, one of those commanders is Laylila the Blade Reforged. Laylila is two and a red for a legendary spirit warrior with haste. Whenever Laylila the Blade Reforged attacks, you exile the top card of your library, and you can play that card this turn. But the ability that really is nice with Reckless Impulse is whenever you exile one or more cards from your library and or graveyard, you put a +1/+1 counter on Laylila. So Reckless Impulse basically buffs your commander. It gives you two cards that you can play, and man, it just does so many good things. Mono Red has been lacking some really good and efficient card draw, and Reckless Impulse is kind of like Light Up the Stage, where it's just such a cheap and efficient way to get you some card advantage. It's not card draw, but it is definitely card advantage. If you're playing Mono Red, you're probably cranking through those cards anyways. I love this card for Laylila. I also think one commander that Dana has is Prosper Tomebound. That card also loves to have things exiled and playing cards out of exile, because Prosper Tomebound says that whenever you play a card from exile, you create a treasure token. So both of these commanders can be just taking full advantage of everything that Reckless Impulse does. Laylila players are only playing Reckless Impulse about 25% of those Laylila decks, and Prosper Tomebound is even less with about 18%. So both of those commanders love everything that Reckless Impulse does. I think that people should be paying more attention to this card. It's not flashy. It's not a glamorous, big, splashy mythic. It's just a regular common from one of these new Innistrad sets, but it does so much work.
Yeah, Matt, Reckless Impulse, definitely a really, really fun card. I'm putting that into a whole bunch of decks, but for Mono Red especially, and if you care about Exile, Heck yeah, that's a really good card. I really like that one. I'm going to move on to my challenge now, and mine is actually the listener-submitted challenge this week. It comes to us from Arnaud Gompertz, who suggested a really cool card that is seeing too much play in a very specific Rakdos deck. So Blim, Comedic Genius, is another Commander Legends card, a 4-mana 4-3 imp with flying, and whenever he deals combat damage to a player, that player will gain control of a permanent that you control, and then each player loses life and discards cards equal to the number of permanents that they control but don't own. So he gives really bad gifts to other people and punishes them for it. And since there are so many, you know, bad cards out there that you could give to your opponents that would cause a bunch of negative things to happen to them, this is probably the reason why the card Lich's Tomb has been showing up in nearly 20% of Blim decks. But according to Arnaud, this is a mistake, and I completely agree with him. Because Lich's Tomb, a 4-mana artifact that says you don't lose the game for having 0 or less life, but which also says if you do lose life, you sacrifice a permanent for each life that you've lost. Yeah, that's a really terrible card to have on your side of the field if you are going to lose a whole bunch of life, for sure, because then you'd have to sacrifice so many permanents. It can be really compounding, really bad. But the way that Blim would give it to people, it doesn't work at all the way that folks would want it to here in a Blim deck. If Blim hits a player and then gives them Lich's Tomb, Blim's effect also makes them lose a life for owning, for controlling something that they don't own, for controlling a thing that you gave them. So then when Lich's Tomb sees that you lost a life, it says you have to sacrifice a permanent, and they can just sacrifice the Lich's Tomb. So it's just kind of a dead card there. It doesn't do what you want it to in that deck. So free that slot up for other nasty gifts that you can give to people instead.
Yeah, that's a really good catch. There's always some of those little...
Catch?
Joey, I'm trying to be serious here. I'm trying to compliment our listener challenge this week, and you're just over here giggling like a little fool. So going to need you to clean it up. Going to need to go sit and think about what you just did.
Matt, I need you to know that I find this line of joking completely repugnant, and I think that we ought to move on to Dana's challenge.
All right, I have a challenge here. It's going to be a real dog and pony show. So let me tell you about a set released in 2003 named Scourge.
Scourge?
More specifically, I'm going to talk about a card from that set that's showing up in just 466 decks in EDH Rec, Faces of the Past. Faces of the Past is an enchantment for 2 and a blue, and it says whenever a creature dies, tap all untapped creatures that share a creature type with it, or untap all tapped creatures that share a creature type with it. Faces of the Past should be in more decks in general, but it should specifically be in more zombie decks. For starters, zombie decks are constantly sacrificing creatures. That's just how people tend to play zombie decks, particularly with introduction of decayed tokens. So Every time you lose a decayed token in a zombie deck with Faces of the Past out, you can just untap all of the zombies that you have that attack during combat, or you can untap all the ones with tap abilities like Shepherd of Rot or Lord of the Undead. As a bonus, there's a bunch of different zombie spells that make tokens that all come into play tap, things like Field of the Dead or Army of the Damned or Dread Summons. When it makes those piles of tokens, they come into play tapped, just sacrifice that Gravecaller that you're going to bring back anyway and untap all of those tapped zombie tokens. You could even do it as a combat trick when someone's swinging in towards you thinking you have no blockers, Alter's Reap on a zombie, untap all your zombies, suddenly you have bodies there to save you. And that's not even before we get into just the accidental value you get from it. If, you know, you Doomblade someone's human wizard, I might as well just tap all of the humans and wizards, because why do I care? It's a really, really good card that should show up probably more in general, but I think if you were playing a zombie deck with access to blue, there's a lot of value you could get from an enchantment that just costs 2 and a blue.
That is really clever tech. I'm going to have to look into this. That's one that I've always looked at and been like, I don't know, it seems like it's just for combos, but like just the general utility that you're describing there is actually pretty nasty.
Why, thank you. And it's from Scourge way back in 2003, so Scourge. It's a deep cut too, which we all like.
I believe it's pronounced Scourge.
Scourge, you guys. You guys are, I don't know what y'all are on right now, but it's too much.
Matt's going at the pronunciation like a dog with a bone. He's tenacious.
So we're going to move into our next half of the show. Let's keep talking about our favorite most complex commanders. Actually, Matt, I'm going to give this next floor to you because I remember when the Strixhaven set came out, this was a very particular thing on your end that was like, this is too much to handle right now. Man, if we can get serious, let's talk about a whole series.
I think it's possible that I get serious, but yeah, kind of like what Joey hinted, every Strixhaven commander, which one? Every single Strixhaven commander could qualify for this list. Not just because like they're doing complex things and specific interactions, but there's a lot of text on every single face of those commanders. I say every face because most of these commanders have two faces. there are so many things working against me ever wanting to build any Strixhaven commander because they're either like there's 30 lines of text. There's so much going on. Like you have two commanders on one card for half of them. And it's just, boy, is it a struggle. It makes me want to go lay down and just cry, whimper a little bit, maybe even. Cause yeah, like every single one of these cards just has so much going on.
Yeah, you've got Jadzi, Oracle of Archaos, that is also Journey to the Oracle. You've got Plarg, Dean of Chaos, that is also Augusta, Dean of Order. You've got Blex, Vexing Pest, which is indeed very vexing because there's a spell on the other half of it.
Yeah.
There are so many going on here. It is a lot to know just what these cards do on either face. And the abilities on each face are indeed pretty complicated. But yeah, it's a lot to keep track of. And I think that that can be overwhelming. As you put it, I think when Strixhaven was coming out, it's just like, I get that it's a school set, but I don't want to feel like I'm studying for the final just to figure out what these cards do.
Yeah. I don't want to have a degree from this school in order to understand what they're going on. Like, even Mila, Crafty Companion, the backside is a Planeswalker, and Planeswalkers are renowned for being very easy to understand, never complicating the board state. Like, there's just so much going on every single one of these cards. Somebody put out a tweet a while back, and I wish I could find it, but the average amount of lines per card in all of these Strixhaven Legends is almost triple what previous sets were. Like, it's just crazy. Like, not just the mechanical complexity, but just the literal amount of words you have to remember for every single legendary. But like Valentin and or Lisette, the Golgari two-faced commander, the Witherbloom commander, there's so much going on. And you're making tokens, and tokens are dying. And when things are dying, you're doing counters. And it just, like, this whole set really made me... I really did zone out. Like, I fell asleep in class because there was just too much going on.
And honestly, though, like, we're saying, like, oh, there's so many words on that. And that is just the thing that makes it feel a bit, like, tidally overwhelming, is just that, like, a lot of these are actually very, very interesting. Lisette, Dean of the Root, the one that you just mentioned there, whenever you gain life, you can pay mana to put a +1 counter on each of your creatures, and those creatures gain trample until the end of turn. Like, on its own, that's enough to parse, but it's attached to another commander on the front side that is almost distracting you from how cool that back half ability is. And that is one of the things that makes it feel overwhelming, even if you can build a very specific and streamlined deck around some of these. A specific one of these that I actually want to call out here is Yuvilda, Dean of Perfection, or more specifically, the better half, Nasari, Dean of Expression. Sorry, not sorry.
No,
we're just about the dog jokes this episode. Okay, yes. Cool. We're just moving on. So Nasari, Dean of Expression, is actually, I think, a tremendously overlooked commander. This thing's like genuinely really, really good. It is a 5-mana 4/4 Efreet Shaman, and it says at the beginning of your upkeep, you exile the top card of each opponent's library. Until end of turn, you may cast spells from among those exiled cards, and you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast those spells. And whenever you cast a spell from exile, you put a +1 counter onto Nasari. This is a very good ability, and I think it's a very overlooked ability because it's being buried by all of the lines of text that are present in this set. But that's basically the stolen strategy enchantment right there on your commander. It is a bunch of card advantage, and it also becomes a commander damage win condition. But the thing that makes this one, to me, especially more complicated to actually execute when you are playing it is just keeping track of where all of the things are that are in exile and where they all came from. Like, Matt, you mentioned that Reckless Impulse card. That is a thing that you have to track differently about the timing of when you can play it than Nasari's own ability or a stolen strategy ability. And this is a deck that often will have, like, you want extra upkeeps with Paradox Haze to give yourself more ability abilities, more triggers off of Nisari to get more card advantage from that ability. So you're tracking additional turns worth of stuff. Like, there's a lot of moving parts. It is a very powerful commander and a very rewarding one to play, but it is also a lot that you have to juggle because there's so many balls in the air.
I mean, I think some of these commanders are just cooked up in a lab. But
we'll never escape it.
You're never escaping this, no.
Never. But yeah, Strixhaven is very complicated, but this is a particular standout that I think is awesome, but also a lot.
And I will also note there's some things that seem silly that add to the complexity here too. Once you get to the point where you have multiple commander decks, you sometimes just forget what the power and toughness of your commander are off the top of your head, or maybe what the exact casting cost is. Is it you know, a white and a red, or is it, you know, whatever. You can just look at it normally. Like, it's right there in front of you as a reminder, or as a reminder for your opponents who are, like, trying to figure out if you have enough mana to cast on the next turn or something. When that face is hidden and you can't see what it is, then you wind up like, okay, can I cast my commander with that Brea out who can do -4/-4 to a creature? Is it a 4 or a 5 toughness? I can't remember. So it does add even a little bit of thing where you have to, like, flip it over and look. And then it becomes obvious to your opponent that you're eyeballing your commander to see if you're going to cast it. Like, there's just a little silly things like that, but that is kind of a added layer of complexity there, where that information is just kind of hidden from anyone to look at and see, including yourself.
Well, you know, there, Dana, you actually mentioned things being hidden. I think that it is very fair of us to shout out Kadena, the Slinking Sorceress here, because Kadena is the Morph Commander. So you will have a whole bunch of face-down creatures, things that are hidden. And this isn't even like a hiding information from opponents thing, but it's literally kind of like you accidentally are doing your own shell game here because you've put a bunch of creatures face-down with really great abilities when they flip face-up. But yeah, what did they do? Where did I put what is happening here? Like, it becomes this, you have to constantly check your own stuff to remind yourself, wait, which one of these is the Willbender? I mean, it's always Willbender.
They're all Willbender.
It's always Willbender, yeah.
It's always Willbender, but there's also going to be a bunch of others. Which one is the Ice Feather Aven? Which one of them is the Sagumaler? I need to remember which one of these is which. And that can just be tricky for yourself to keep track of, even if it isn't looking like that on the other side of the field, maybe. Like, that is another one that involves hidden information that you also will have to constantly probably double check.
Yeah. It's the rules, I guess, are also something to mention here too. How Morph works seems kind of simple, but it isn't. Morph doesn't use a stack either. And that's something very difficult for new players to wrap your head around. It's difficult for old players to wrap their head around sometimes.
I forgot about that. I literally forgot about it until you just mentioned it right this moment. Yes, you can flip face up as a special action. The ability will use the stack, but you don't actually use the stack to actually flip face up. You're right. And that can have interactions when you're like, you can actually flip face up a morph thing in response to a split second spell.
Yep.
Like, that is an interaction that you are right. See, this stuff, it gets complex. It's crazy.
Every dog has his day, Joey, and the morph reference was had his day today, talking about how complex that one is.
I'm just listeners can't see it, but I'm just shaking my head right now. It was just mm-mm. That was too much, Dana. Come on, man.
So talking about complex rules interactions, I'm going to give this one to you, Joey. I know you. This is kind of one you want to talk about.
Oh no.
So I will let you introduce this next complex.
Are you about
rules
to
interaction commander, I guess.
Are you about to say the thing? Are you about to say the mutate thing? Is that okay? Yes. We just have to take a moment to address mutate commanders are exceptionally a lot to deal with. So for example, Otrimi the Ever Playful, the Sultai mutant commander, it has a 6/6. It's got trample, and whenever, you know, this creature deals combat damage to a player, you'll return a mutant from your graveyard to your hand. That's all well and good. The issue is the mutate mechanic itself, which you can pay a cheaper cost for, and when you cast the spell for its mutate cost, you put it over or under target non-human creature that you own. They mutate into the creature on top, plus all abilities under it. Thankfully, we've had enough time that I think most of us are kind of vaguely familiar with the cadence of how mutate works, but that is still an extraordinarily complicated ability. I would argue it's up there with banding, personally, in terms of grok ability and being so difficult to parse what actually goes on there, because there are so many things that you may not notice at first. There are so many words hidden in that rules text, like that the fact that it can't be a human, which is a mistake that some players will make sometimes when they try to mutate onto a blighted agent and don't realize that that's not actually a legal game action. Or, for example, example, it has to be a creature that you own, not one that you control, which is a distinction that can come up in a lot of very weird contexts, and you might not catch it right away. So in addition to the fact that it's just like a bit of a wonky thing to get used to how it all works, and what happens if the creature gets countered and you're still casting the mutate spell, does it still hit the battlefield? There's a bunch of those rules interactions, and then there's also just like, it feels like there are brand new words hidden in that rules text every time I read a mutant, and that one definitely wins a very complicated award for me.
Well, and unlike banding, mutate's quite good. Like, people tend to not play banding, so you never have to deal with the rules interactions there. That's not the case with mutate. It's quite a powerful mechanic. You see mutate show up quite a bit at commander tables, and I found like the best way to interact with it basically is just kill the player playing mutate. Like, you can just not deal with the rules if they're not in the game any longer. I found that's really kind of the best shortcut there.
I mean, leave it to Dana to hound somebody about what deck they're playing and just the strategies.
I just want to grab that rolled up newspaper and whack them for playing that deck.
I like the mental image of you being like Dana looking at a board and being like, how will I deal with this? Oh, I'll just attack the player. Oh, come on, okay. Matt. That was a good one and you know it.
I will never forgive you.
I used that one earlier. Don't steal my joke.
I'm pretty sure you're just Googling these as we're recording at this point. Like, that's the only way that I will believe.
In Joey's defense, as far as puns go, he's kind of the underdog here.
That is true. That is true.
King, you dropped this, King. That was perfect. Oh, man. Matt, do you have another complex commander that you'd like to shout out here? Another favorite or another anti-favorite commander that you think is kind of a lot to deal with, but maybe it can be rewarding, or is it not worth the effort?
Yeah.
What's another?
I mean, I have one that people might find a little familiar, but it's fairly new too, though. But Runo Stromkirk. Thank you, Joey. Thank you. It's trickling in slowly but surely. But yes. Mm-hmm. But Runo Stromkirk, that's a fairly new commander that just has, it feels like it's fighting itself. Like, there's a little bit of top deck manipulation that you want to be doing, but also there's sea creature tribal with all the krakens and all sorts of different creature types on Runo Stromkirk. And then you can fit some other strategy in there, Joey. I'm not going to say the R word because you're going to shout it at me.
Reanimator's so good.
Yes. But yeah, like, Runo Stromkirk, just any commander that has a few different strategies going on that are all mentioned specifically on the face of the card, those are always going to be a little scattered and just maybe not mechanically complex like some of the other commanders that we've talked about, but the deck building process gets very complex because there are so many things you need to be mindful in that deck building process, whether it's making sure you have enough sea creatures in the deck that you can be cheating out and enough ways to make sure that you're manipulating the top deck of your, you know, as you're going through, because you want to make sure you're hitting as many creatures as possible. There are so many things you need to be mindful of, and Runo Stromkirk maybe specifically isn't the most complex as far as all the things going on the card, but it's also kind of a signpost type of commander for other legendary creatures out there that have kind of fighting strategies that are going on there that you just need to be mindful of when you're building the deck.
I like that. Yeah, there's like, in order to make the commander work, you have to make sure that you've set stuff up, and that involves some graveyard stuff, and that involves like just packing all of that stuff in and also making sure that you still have room for enough removal and enough card draw and enough mana acceleration and different things like that. Yeah, it can get a whole lot. And I guess, Matt, does this mean we don't talk about Runo? No. We don't talk about... He hasn't seen that movie, so never mind. We're just gonna move on from that. We're only about the dog jokes, apparently.
Yeah, I don't even know what just happened there.
Okay. Well, for the record, I'm proud of myself. I thought it was fun. But yeah, no, I totally feel that. That isn't one that even necessarily is rules complicated, but just like making sure that the deck works in the brewing stage can be quite a whole lot. I think there's probably also, you know, probably room for us to shout out that like cards that set new rules, like Doran the Siege Tower, which makes every creature fight not with its power, but with its toughness instead. That can be a rules thing that is also difficult to track over the course of the game sometimes as well.
Any commander kind of like Doran that just messes with the static, not maybe static abilities, but the state of what's going on the board. Those are always just little things that I know I have caught myself many times forgetting, like, oh yeah, that card is still around. So now I messed up.
Well, and it also, I think, involves more of that dynamic of like reminding opponents how that works, because they will probably not be used to that dynamic, and it could change things around that are easily forgettable because we have so many of these, you know, these lines of play kind of that we expect in our heads that we're used to, that are familiar to us, and that we kind of lean on just mental shortcuts and shorthands and stuff like that. But that can be one of those. Or Hirobi Death's Wail, that's another huge one. Whenever creatures get targeted, they are immediately sacrificed because of Hirobi's ability. Suddenly you can't put Lightning Greaves onto your commander, and suddenly pinging a commander will actually kill it instead. That is also a completely different dynamic to try and get used to when a Hirobi is on the battlefield.
We've been focused here mainly talking about commanders that are very complex, but I think we can maybe spend a few minutes talking about cards in the 99 that add a lot of complexity too. And the first one that jumps out at me here is Sphinx of the Second Sun. And it doesn't seem that complicated. It's basically one sentence on the card. It says, at the beginning of your post-combat main phase, you get an additional beginning phase after this phase.
Sure.
So that shouldn't be that bad, but it uses the word phase way too many times. And the problem there is the trigger happens at the beginning of your post-combat main phase, but you don't get the actual beginning phase until after that post-combat main phase is over. That's a really easy thing to miss just reading that card, to the point where when it first came out, we were playing in a game on twitch.tv/EDHRecast.
There it is. There
with,
it is.
With level 20 judge Sheldon Menery. And all of us, including most of chat, got the card wrong.
Yeah. Well, specifically, what we missed is that it is a triggered ability, not just a thing that adds in one more phase there. That is actually a trigger, which is a thing that you can respond to and do extra stuff with. And that makes it like, I'm sorry, wait, what?
Well, you know it's bad when, yeah, Sheldon Menery, who, like, if he wanted to, he could just, like, show up and judge a Pro Tour if they still existed. But, like, he was like he even would sit there. He's like, wait, this has been out for three turns. And I think we've been doing it wrong the entire time. And then he realized, oh, because we've done it differently three different times. And so, yeah, like, that card is just absolutely so silly that even when one of the most intelligent judges in the entire game, the progenitor of the Commander format, is kind of like, wait, I'm not doing this right, am I? That's probably a sign.
There's so much going on in that one. And that actually reminds me of another I've got to shout out here. I still see some folks mess up Morawg, Fury of Aukum. And by some folks, I do include myself here. Morawg is a very cool landfall creature that will give all of your stuff an extra +1 for each time that it has attacked this turn. And it gives you extra combat steps. But there's a very specific timing that you have to do when you actually get those extra combat steps. Whenever a land enters the battlefield under your control, if it's your main phase, there gets an additional combat phase after this phase. And then at the beginning of that combat, you will untap all of your creatures so that they can attack again. The thing is, this isn't a thing that's going to give you an extra main phase after that combat phase. So you'll attack, move to your second main, play your lands as you would play a Relentless Assault or some other, you know, extra combat spell. But then that's it. You get that one time to play all of the lands for the extra combats. And he will give you a bunch of extra combats. But after those combats, it's straight to the end step. That is a complicated thing to kind of try and track. And it just involves, you know, moving the stages and the turnaround, and that can be a bit difficult. It's a great card, but there's a lot to track on it, in addition to the fact that you have to track how many times each creature has attacked to get those extra bonuses. It's great, but yeah, extra stages really throws us for a mental loop.
Well, if we're going to talk about red cards that get confusing, I also am going to throw one out there, and it's probably the only card that every single time somebody has played it, we have to resolve it sentence by sentence, word by word. And that card, Wheel of Misfortune. And if you can tell me what that card does off the top of your head, I will give you the biggest high five ever. Because I've seen it resolve several times. And every single time, all four people at the table, okay, what's the first thing we do? What's the next thing we do? So Wheel of Misfortune, folks, for you, everyone at home, says each player secretly chooses a number, zero or greater, and then all players reveal those numbers simultaneously and determine the highest and lowest numbers revealed this way. And then Wheel of Misfortune deals damage equal to the highest number to each player who chose that number. And then each player who didn't choose the lowest number discards their hand, then draw 7 cards. I literally just read that, and I still don't think I could resolve it properly.
Yeah.
It makes me just want to roll over and just cry.
I see what you did there. I see what you did there. That's great. I think also this is a great place to mention some of the most infamously difficult or complex cards to play. But these aren't always ones that we necessarily see very commonly in EDH. So, you know, Chains of Mephistopheles, which I can't read it. If you know, you know. Banding is, of course, another, you know, very famously complicated ability. Doomsday has so many different lines of play that you can set up by slimming your deck down. That is also, I mean, books have been written about that one. Illusory Mask, Knowledge Pool. The card Dead Ringers is another one that is just like a single sentence, but it doesn't make any sense. Like, those are some of the most famous, you know, very complex cards. But I don't know if they always show up too often in Commander games. But Dana, I know that there's a white enchantment that you see very often in Commander games that is so much that it becomes too much, and you have some thoughts about it.
Gathra's Crusade. It's an amazing card. It puts a +1 counter on your creatures whenever a creature comes into play. It's a legitimate way to win games in white. It's a win condition. It's also super, super annoying to keep track of, as we saw last week on twitch.tv/EDHRedcast. It's just a lot. You need a lot of dice and counters, and you need to be constantly paying attention, and it's just a mess to the point where I've taken it out of decks in the past because it was too frustrating to deal with.
Really? Really? I still love it. But, I mean, you're right. It is a lot to try and track. Okay, this has the one counter, but this just entered. So these have more counters. But then, wait, do these have the same amount of counters? Like, yeah, it can be a lot. And it's just very, if anything, even if you understand what's going on, it's just very fiddly and it's a whole lot to do. But I'm surprised that you've actually taken it out. I feel like it can still be so potent that I find that worth it. But
I will expand on that. It was a deck. It was the original Tesa. Is it Envoy of Ghosts, I believe? The one that makes a spirit when a black creature you control dies.
Oh.
And it was a deck built around sacrificing creatures I could bring back very easily, resembling Skeleton, Brood of Cockroaches, things like that. So in addition to the Gathra's Crusade stuff, the deck was constantly like putting creatures in the graveyard and bringing a small one back, like doing that 4 or 5 times in a turn. So it was a fiddly deck to begin with, and Crusade combined with that, while logical, just made the mess that much messier.
Gotcha.
And that was easy thing to pull out to make the train wreck slightly less of a train wreck.
Tesa Orzhov Scion being the one there.
Oh, yes.
The 3-mana version. I can see that getting to be a whole lot. So I definitely understand that one. I do think, though, that there is also something here, and maybe this is a distinction, like you just mentioned, an extremely fiddly deck that has a whole lot. But I also have noticed sometimes that when I'm playing my Thalise Reverent Medium deck, that this is a deck that actually, I think it looks more complicated than it is. And this is one other final note that I think would be interesting to throw into this discussion, that there are some decks that might look like they're complicated, but that actually aren't necessarily. My Thalise deck has so many different tokens that I have to find this is a spirit or this is a zombie or this is a thrall or different things like that. And, you know, counting up how many of them you have. But the actual cards that I'm using to create a bunch of soldiers or spirits or whatever, it doesn't necessarily take up too much brain power, I suppose, but it is kind of time-consuming to execute. And the fact that it can be a little time-consuming probably makes it look more complicated than it actually is. And I think that's an important thing to note, too. Sometimes things look intimidating and look like, whoa, what's even going on here? This is really a lot to try and grapple with. But they can actually be, once you are in the driver's seat of them, you actually kind of get to see how all of the gears connect together. And sometimes they can be a lot more straightforward than originally it first looks. So I think that's another thing that is worth noting here. Just because it takes up a whole lot of, maybe it's time-consuming or something like that, doesn't necessarily mean that it is too complex. And it can be pretty grokkable for sure.
Yeah, I mean, always having some amount of familiarity with your commander, like with Thalise or any whatever the commander is, especially these more complex ones, that's always going to just help speed up the game. And then knowing, just like Dana taking out Gathra's Crusade, which I think is wrong. Let's be real. That card is so good. but making it a more fun play experience for yourself and for others, that I get it. Like, but just having some amount of reps before you start sitting down and playing the deck super regularly, just take some time, goldfish a little bit. Yeah, I get it, Joey. You want to make sure that you're not just going in blind, especially some of these more complex commanders.
Yeah, there is a very achievable amount of comfort that is possible with all of them that is important to keep in mind, because none of these things are impossible to be able to figure out. Basically, if something looks intimidating, giving it an extra chance will actually like help you realize how complex it may or may not actually be, because it might look more complex than it really is. And ultimately, Matt, at the end of the day, I think it's just a lesson that we want to share with everyone not to terrier yourself up about.
I already used that one, you goober.
You stole from me, I steal from you. That's how it works, buddy.
I'm going to put you in a cone of shame.
With that, how about we call this ridiculous episode to a close? Fellas, if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where is it that they can find us all? Matt?
So you can find me on the Twitters, at Mathimus55, that's MathImus55. And if you want to come watch all the, spend the dog days of summer with us, you can do so over at twitch.tv/EDHRetcast, where we're playing games every single Wednesday evening.
And Dana, where can the paparazzi find you?
You Googled that one. You Googled that one and you know it.
Guilty, guilty. I'm guilty of that one.
You can find me on Twitter at Dana Roach. You can hear me on the other podcast, CMDR Central. I'm writing articles for both EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at the Dog Pound, aka patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter, and you can find the cast at EDHRecCast on Facebook and on Twitter. Plus, if you've got a question for us, you can contact us at EDHRecCast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Josh LeQuiet, the whole team at the Command Zone, for handling the post-production work on the podcast and for putting up with us. And we want to thank our sponsors, TCG Player and CardKingdom.com. And you can visit altersleeves.com/EDHRecCast for cool custom EDH Rec sleeves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.